This is Central Time. When we think of historic Wisconsin fires, the Great Peshtigo Fire of 1871 is one of the first to come to mind. But the author of a new book tells the story of another great 1800s fire, one among the deadliest unsolved possible arsons in American history. Matthew Prigge is an author and historian from Milwaukee. He created the What Made Milwaukee Famous radio series for WMSE Radio in Milwaukee, and his latest book is called Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire That Defined an Era. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's set the scene as you do in the book. Tell us about this desire in Milwaukee to have a fancy luxury hotel to make us make Milwaukee a stronger rival to cities like Chicago.
Well, this was back in the 1850s, and there was this belief among a lot of civic boosters and businessmen, and particularly the Milwaukee Sentinel newspaper, that having a luxury hotel here was really what Milwaukee needed to keep up with Chicago. As you might know, that Milwaukee and Chicago were pretty near equal in terms of, or fairly equal in terms of population up until the time that the railroads came to the American Midwest, and that kind of set Chicago apart as the more obvious hub for goods coming in from the west, shipping into the east. So Milwaukee kind of latched onto this idea of having a world-class hotel here as a way to try to regain footing in that that competition with Chicago.
And along comes this grocer, a successful builder of a grain elevator, who finds himself in the hotel business. What happened?
The Daniel Newhall came to Milwaukee in the 1840s, right around the time things were starting to take off, and he had a grocery business. He traded in grain. He made himself a fortune, and he wanted to get into the hotel business. He was the one that kind of took the initiative to build this palace, and he had the money to do so, and he also had kind of a tendency to take big risks, to invest big, and he was the one who went all in on this idea of a world-class hotel in the city.
Now, a little foreshadowing here. You keep quoting newspaper articles that said, well, since this block burned down, this would be a great place to have a hotel. Fires, it seemed like were a fact of life through the 1800s in Milwaukee.
Yeah, they were very common, and in a lot of ways, it's surprising that there weren't more disastrous fires like this. You said, the area of, a hotel and a barn would burn down, and they'd be like, the Sentinel would be out 2 days later saying what a great spot this would be for a new luxury hotel.
Now tell us about this Newhall House Hotel that ended up finally being built.
Well, it was pretty audacious for its time in both the size and the luxury. As you mentioned in the intro, it might have been, at the time it was completed in 1857, the tallest building in the country, and possibly the tallest inhabitable building in the country and maybe in the world. There really wasn't much of a competition for that then. I don't think in 1850 having the tallest hotel in the world would have been considered much of a thing, because this building, by modern standards, wasn't very tall. It was only six stories. But, they really went big with it. It had a very ornate cupola at the very top from which you could see the entire city. Every luxury you could imagine in 1857, the Newhall House had it.
Talking to historian Matthew Prigge about his new book, Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire That Defined an Era. Well, talk a little bit before we get to the big fire, Matthew, about the history of this hotel between building and destruction. A lot of ups and a lot more downs along the way, it seems like.
Yeah, it was, if the idea was bold to put a hotel of this scope in Milwaukee, there was probably a reason for that. There really wasn't a great market for these high-end hotel rooms. Almost as soon as they built it, or as soon as it was opened, there were rumors that it was in financial trouble. The first two men who took out the lease on it, they were only able to pay a fraction of what they had agreed on as the lease price back to Daniel Newhall. Newhall owned it for about a decade until he sold it. He ended up selling it for about half of what it cost him to build it. It transferred through a number of hands over the next couple decades. Just nobody really able to make a go at it, both proprietors, the people who ran it, and Eventually, it was sold into a kind of a stock company of local businessmen who really just wanted to make sure that it stayed open and not to have this giant luxurious building just sitting there. So very hard to make money with the Newhall House, either owning it or operating it.
And briefly, before we get to the big fire, there were a couple of significant fires in this hotel along the way, right?
Yeah, there were a few. One where they actually removed some rooms from the hotel that had been burned through. And allegedly, a couple of fires that were purposely set by persons to this day unknown.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Matthew Prigge. He is a historian from Milwaukee, author of several historical books. His latest, we're talking about it now, is Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire That Defined an Era. Matthew, take us to the night of the fire. What were the first signs that the Newhall House Hotel was on fire?
Well, this was January 1883, and it was about 3 a.m. Pretty much everybody in the house, except for the three staff members who were on duty that night, were asleep. And there was a porter who was coming down in the elevator. He dropped somebody off on an upper floor, and he was going back down to the lobby floor, which was on the second floor, and smoke started to fill the elevator. So he hopped off. He got the guy at the front desk, and they went down to the basement, and they found that it was full of smoke, and there was a fire of, they weren't exactly sure where it was at the time. They're pretty sure it was at the base of the elevator shaft. And by that time, the fire was already pretty well underway. It's catching in the elevator shaft like that. It was able to spread very quickly because in elevators of those times, they actually had open caps on the roof above the elevator shaft, and especially it being such a cold night, just the warm air of the hotel was being drawn up through this elevator shaft. So as soon as it got going in the basement near the base of the elevator shaft, the flames pretty much shot right up to the roof within, I imagine, a few minutes of it really getting going.
Now, ultimately, over 70 people are going to die. The hotel's going to be destroyed. But those first people to see the fire, you write, make a pivotal decision. They try to fight it themselves. They don't call the fire company.
Correct. Well, they did call upon the first sight of fire, they ran into the basement. They tried to assess the situation themselves. They, as many of the fires that had occurred at the hotel before, were handled in-house, either with the fire hoses or they had buckets of water pretty much kept everywhere in case of fire. So they made that assumption that this was something they'd be able to handle themselves. And by the time, you know, we're talking just a few minutes here, but by the time they realized that this was beyond their control, you could say that the house, the fate of the house was pretty much sealed.
Talk about the efforts of, once the fire companies were alerted, their efforts to try to save as many people as they could.
Well, the firefighting profession back then was still pretty Spartan. There's not a lot of training done comparative to today. These were a lot of the people who were in charge of fire companies were political appointees. So it was kind of a mixed bag and a rugged group of people who whose daring, I write, might have overshadowed any formal training they had. But by the time they got there, they had pretty much given up. Again, this is maybe 10 minutes after the fire is discovered. They pretty much given up on trying to fight it from inside by any decent means. So they were pretty much fighting the fire from the streets through the windows and trying to get ladders up to the people who by this time had woken up, and a lot of them were pushed back by the fire and trapped in their rooms.
A lot of your book tells the story of those who perished and survived the fire. I'll leave that to readers. We could take hours to talk about all those separate stories. Tell us where the title of your book came from, Damn the Old Tinderbox.
There's a lot of newspaper accounts of the things that happened in the streets as this fire was going on, and the quote or the statement is taken from a quote that I think it was the Milwaukee Sentinel. Apparently, they observed a man running away from the building, screaming, "Damn the old tinderbox! Damn Milwaukee!"
And did this, after the fire, did this change things in terms of how the city dealt with fire, how firefighters dealt with fire in reaction to this hugely catastrophic fire?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was one of the interesting things that I found out in doing this, because the narrative of this that does exist in Milwaukee histories, you know, sometimes they'll follow up the story of the fire by saying that, well, Milwaukee as a city made some changes in the names in the name of fire safety, but not much happened in the aftermath of this fire in terms of requiring more from the people who own these buildings, more clearly marked fire exits, things like that. In fact, just a few months after the Newhall House fire, later in 1883, there was a fire that started kind of similarly in the basement at the Plankinton House, which was by that time the city's leading luxury hotel. And this fire had the fortune of starting right around the dinner hour, so everybody was awake. It was spotted very quickly. They called the fire department and put it out. There was some damage, but no loss of life or anything. And afterwards, the fire chief basically admitted, you know, if this had happened in the middle of the night, it probably would have been another Newhall House.
Matthew, I don't want to let you go without talking about some of the mystery here. The big question, sure. Was this fire intentional? Was this arson? What do we know?
Well, it's not to spoil anything, but I do approach a couple of different what I view as the most likely scenarios as to how the fire would have started. There was a lot of talk about these previous fires that had been set at the Newhall, and that obviously raises a lot of red flags. But there, in the aftermath of the big fire, there was really no, you know, people talked about it in sort of hushed tones. They're like, well, we knew who was doing that, and they've left the city, and they're, you know, that wasn't a problem anymore. So if anybody was, you know, in the know on who this person might have been, there was really no interest in that person after this fire. There was also a bartender, the proprietor of the bar at the Newhall House, who was actually charged and put on trial for setting the fire. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that by the end of that trial, the city was basically celebrating his acquittal, because it became so clear that he had nothing to do with this. And the other scenario, the one that, well, I'll leave that one for the reader to find out on their own. There's a little mystery there. It was not necessarily of malicious intent, but might have been an accidental setting of the fire.
Matthew, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Matthew J. Priggy is an author and historian from Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about his new book, Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire that Defined an Era. You can hear Matthew talk about his new book at the official launch on Tuesday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee.